Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are listening to CPA Review, and more you are listening to CPA Review, and more you are listening to CPA Review, and more you are listening to CPA Review, and more.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you're joining from. And thank you for listening to this episode of CPA Review and More with your host, Phil Yeager. I'm your producer and director here at the Yeager Studios, Rob Medford, and together we are bringing you the number one podcast for CPAs and CPA candidates. If you're new to the show, I'd like to be the first to thank you for checking us out. We're excited to have you as part of our listenership. If you're here because you've already heard our show and you're a continued listener, we thank you for the ongoing support. It's always greatly appreciated. If you're in the market for a CPA review course or simply want to know more about what Yeager CPA Review has to offer, check out our website at YeagerCPAReview.com or call our office and we'll answer any questions you might have. The link and telephone number will be in the description of this episode. Here at Team Yeager, we're excited to tell you about our new Yeager CPA Review subscription format. It's the same great Yeager CPA Review course that you know and love on an all-new, month-to-month, no long-term commitment subscription format. But without any further delay, I'm going to pass the microphone on over to your host, Billy Yeager.
Well, thank you very much, Rob. Chris, it's good to have you on. And Chris is coming to us from Australia. Hey, what part are you in, by the way?
I'm in South Australia, Adelaide, South Australia, more specifically. So if you kind of look at the map, it's kind of in the middle, right down the bottom, near the beach, which is pretty good.
Now, you are a chartered accountant in Australia, correct?
Yeah.
And you consider yourself an accounting futurist. Now, what exactly do you mean by that, that you're an accounting futurist?
Well, I guess it was a play on words, basically merging, the profession of accounting with the profession of, you know, futurology or foresight or whatever you want to call it. You know, people that practice in that field are called futurists. It's kind of an emerging field or school of thought. You know, it's actually only just started being formally taught at colleges like in the last few years. I'm not formally trained by any measure, but I guess, you know, age of the internet these days, I kind of went down a rabbit hole on kind of like YouTube, and that ended up at Open Universities and Udemy and all of those sorts of, you know, online training programs, and just started learning more and more about it. So I kind of like hacked my education in that space. And it has been very useful for me in terms of, I guess, the accounting profession, in terms of my work there, but then I guess in the broader kind of economic perspective. And I think the interesting thing for your listeners, Phil, is that I guess foresight involves a lot of fundamental sort of accounting, finance, economic principles anyway. So I think it's pretty easy for accountants to actually pick up, almost second nature.
Are you familiar with U.S. generally accepted accounting principles?
Yes, I am.
How does the accounting principles in Australia differ in any way?
You know, I kind of liken the IFRS versus GAAP thing to the metric system versus imperial system thing, where it's like, I guess the rest of the world is kind of on IFRS and, you know, on the metric system. And then the United States have got US GAAP and they've got the imperial system. Look, in terms of like the differences between, you know, a set of IFRS, you know, financial statements versus a set of GAAP financial statements, look, I think it's very easy for accountants to kind of like pick up one or the other pretty easily. I would say that the biggest disparities I've kind of noticed in terms of accounting around the world is difference in tax policies and codes and practices and that sort of thing. IFRS versus GAAP, I mean, it does get super technical and technically complex when you actually dive deep into the minutiae. But, you know, an IFRS versed accountant will be able to pick up a set of US GAAP, you know, financial statements and navigate their way through it, just as, you know, an American, you know, US GAAP trained accountant would be able to pick up a set of IFRS statements and navigate their way through that, you know. And at the end of the day, this is all disclosed in the notes anyway, so you can kind of read the notes and kind of get a pretty good understanding of what's going on. That's not to say, again, you can't, you know, consult and practice in the detail without a fair bit of work, but for all intents and purposes, you know, accounting is accounting at the end of the day. The debits still go on the left no matter where you are.
There is a convergence right now of U.S. GAAP converging over to IFRS.
I call it IFRS, but that's probably IFRS. More an Australian accent thing.
So U.S. GAAP is trying to pick up the same rules as international accounting standards.
That's
so
right.
I think at some point we're going to be heading towards that, and I think they will basically be the same. Now, I know a few of the areas are the same rules, like leases. We're now using your international financial accounting principles for leases. Leases have changed.
That's right. And that's been a very topical one, I guess, you know, recently, both here and over in the United States as well. And I think the reason for the adaptation of, you know, the IFRS leasing standard is to do with a number of like corporate collapses, you know, in sort of recent memory in the last 10 decade, where it's kind of like, well, if this standard had have existed, you know, prior, it would have actually prevented, not prevented entirely, but obviously mitigated some of these collapses.
Can you give an example you just said specifically?
Not off the top of my head, I'm afraid, in terms of specific companies. And honestly, I'd be remiss to actually bring any of them up on air. But look, they're pretty evident, you know, within the accounting and financial press if you spend a while on Google.
If I'm a CPA in the United States, yeah. Is there any reciprocity to your knowledge that I could come over, and do I need to get a chartered accounting in Australia, or is a demand for US CPAs in Australia?
So there is some degree of reciprocity between the Institute of Chartered Accountants and CPA America, AICPA. There's obviously bridging like requirements depending on sort of like if you're Australian going over to American or vice versa. And that's mainly, I guess, in the localization aspects of practice, right? So the two things that come to mind are financial accounting, obviously the IFRS versus GAAP thing that we spoke about before, but then also taxation as well. You know, I remember my first time, you know, picking up, you know, a tax return in the United States, and just like it read like a completely different like foreign language, simply because I'd spent, you know, so many years in Australian tax. And I guess it's a bit naive to think that, you know, all tax systems are the same worldwide. And I mean, I think the good thing about, you know, all of these qualifications and designations is that it does teach the fundamentals, right? So I think every accountant walks out of the CPA program or the CA program understanding, well, what is sales tax? And explain to me the difference between like a sales tax and a value-added tax, right? They understand how payroll tax works. They understand how income tax works, et cetera, et cetera. So I think those, you know, overarching concepts in terms of tax theory, they commute very well, you know, from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. And like literally what you need to learn is it's like, well, where does that go on the form, you know? And that can be a pretty steep learning curve.
Well, there are a lot of US companies that have offices in Australia, correct?
Yes, that's right. And vice versa.
Now, I would think the US companies need people who are familiar with US GAAP. Do they then bring in CPAs from the States? Do you know what's going on with that?
Look, I think they mostly work with like the big four firms, you know, because I do know of some American tax and US GAAP sort of like practicing accountants that work in public. And I can tell you that they all work at the big four firms. The one thing I will point out though, is that I have noticed this trend, which wouldn't have happened 20 years ago, of smaller practices actually starting to kind of bridge the international gap. And the reason for this is, I guess, the democratization of commerce over the last sort of 10 years, you know, which has been accelerated by the internet, meaning that, you know, your average startup punter with, say, like $500,000 in turnover, they're operating out of six different countries. And I've seen this firsthand with, you know, some of my clients, particularly in e-commerce, where it's like, you know, the day they open shop, they're exporting to six different countries, you know, and we're suddenly having to file like, you know, tax forms and all of that sort of stuff and working with, you know, accounting firms, I guess, around the world to actually attend to sort of like the localized lodgements and that sort of thing.
What do you mean by smaller CPA? Is it smaller firms you're talking about?
Yeah. I'm talking like two, three partner firms. Sorry?
Two, three partner firms, really?
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a demand for that now? There's becoming a bigger demand?
Yeah, well, I mean, again, if you pick this kind of like cheesy, cliched, you know, startup, you know, example, where it's like, you know, some kids just set up an e-commerce, you know, shop selling, you know, soap out of their mum's basement, right? And then suddenly there's a huge demand for this soap and, you know, they're dispatching orders to wholesalers in Europe and in North America and, you know, South America, you know, all from their mom's basement in, you know, in Australia. It's like, well, that's actually a pretty complicated business. Now, typically, you know, you couldn't even go into business like that from your mom's basement, nonetheless. And also, like, you know, you may be exporting to, say, six different countries, but you're also, you know, you don't really have the big four budget of paying like $1,500 an hour for partner time on the file, right? So I guess the market has kind of addressed that one organically, where I'm seeing small boutique firms that are kind of working with clients that are running international businesses. And I don't think this situation was as prolific as it was sort of 10 years ago.
Because these companies you would be talking about that are doing this type of shipping or doing work with several different countries, if they went to an accounting firm, that accounting firm would have to know all the different tax rules.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Now, I mean, what size firm do you think someone could go to and get those expertise? So, you know, if I set up a business in Australia and yep. I'm shipping to 10 different countries. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now you said I can't afford going to the big four. Yep. They don't have the money. So I'll go to a smaller firm. All right. Yep. Is your smaller firms there equipped to do that type of, you know, taxes for different countries? Are you aware of the tax laws?
Look, I think some are and some aren't. And I think that's kind of, you know, where the onus is on the entrepreneur themselves to kind of ask the right questions and kind of do their due diligence. But, you know, it's absolutely a matter of, like, particularly if you go to someone who specializes in your industry. So if you were to engage an e-commerce specialist accountant, well, it goes without saying that e-commerce, you know, companies are shipping, you know, across multiple borders. And you would expect them to have, an understanding of the tax requirements across all of these different jurisdictions. And it's not necessarily to say that they can file the forms and all of that sort of stuff. I doubt that actually legally be even able to, but at least they'll be able to advise the client going, okay, you're exporting to, you know, to Europe. You understand that you've got, you know, VAT obligations over there. We recommend that, you know, we work with, you know, so-and-so from, you know, this firm in France. And you know, we've worked with them on client files before and they'll be able to help you out with this one. Here's their rates, you know.
You mentioned a value added tax.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't
right.
think a lot of people in the States know what that is.
Okay, yeah.
Well, we have. What is your value added tax?
Well, I mean, that's what it's called in Europe, in Australia and New Zealand. It's called goods and services tax. I think the key consideration here is that it's a tax passed along the value chain, where basically people along the value chain get credits for the VAT or the GST that they'd paid previously.
Is that in lieu of a state income tax?
Sorry, a state income. Oh, state income tax. Yeah, so funny story about that here in Australia. The goods and services tax was introduced in the year 2000, basically to be administered federally, but then distributed to the states. And it's a constant point of contention in terms of how the goods and services tax actually gets distributed between the states. And rightly so, because do you distribute GST on a per capita basis, right? Or do you distribute GST based on which states have produced that goods and services tax? And, you know, it's funny, you know, we've got a state here in Australia, Western Australia, which I guess is, you know, the equivalent of your Texas, where, you know, they've been talking about, you know, succession, what is it, secession for probably the last 100 years or so.
Seceding from the union, yes.
Yep, and it keeps coming up, you know, in this GST debate, because in fairness, like, Western Australia is punching well above its weight in terms of what it's contributing, both in terms of the economy and in terms of goods and services tax. But then when it comes to the remittances that they get federally, you know, they're left a little short change because they've actually got a lower population.
Do you have your own business there in Australia? What is your business?
So at the moment, I work for a company called Acodex. The short, you know, response is it's a market network for freelance accountants. That's the elevator pitch. But I guess for those that are listening, it's essentially, I guess, a back office for startup and wannabe accountants, right? So I like to use the analogy saying, like, well, let's say that you're an angry young accountant, you're in your late 20s, you're a CPA, you've been in public for, say, 10 years. And you want to go start up your own practice, but you honestly just have no idea where to start. Acodex is a good place to start, because kind of what we've done is we've bottled up all of the technology and all of the best practices and procedures and training and coaching and all of that sort of stuff. We've bottled that all up, and, you know, you kind of, you've got that on your first day, rather than having to learn sort of by trial and error, you know, which is what I did when I first went into practice. And I wouldn't recommend it to anyone.
So if I'm an accountant, I want to start a practice, is it any place or just Australia?
No. It's, well, any place, you know, within reason. So at this juncture, you know, Australia and the United States, but no doubt, you know, it'll roll into, I guess, other countries. As I think the big contributor or consideration here is technology. I guess as technology evolves in each different country, in terms of accounting technology, is probably where a codex will expand into later. Basically, anything that you would classify as an overhead in accounting practice kind of gets taken care of on the Acodex side of things, right? So if you go into practice, you're going to have fixed costs and overheads like software licenses and subscription. You've got training, and you've got all of these other departments and functions that you can't even afford to hire when you're in sole practice. So you think about marketing, you think about HR, IT, and or even finance in terms of accounts receivable and the administration of all of that. Anything that's not billable kind of happens on the Acodex side. Anything that's billable happens on the practitioner side. It's a network of, like, you know, practicing accountants in North America and Australia who share similar values, ideals, and interests. Okay. They share sort of like overhead costs and fixed costs. And, you know, it's like if other people want to join, it's absolutely something where it's like, yeah, okay, cool, we'll consider you, assuming that you're fit. And I guess the upside that you get is that, you know, instead of being in practice on your own, you're now in practice with a whole bunch of like-minded peers who share the same values as you do, and, you know, want the best for you as well.
Where did you get the idea to start this company? I mean,
Well, I started in sole practice on my own by myself, you know, and a friend of mine from school. And it was incredibly isolating and, you know, lonely. And we had to learn everything the hard way by trial and error. We wasted a lot of time and money, you know, making the mistakes that every single sole practitioner does when they first start up. And I thought to myself, wouldn't it be nice if, you know, I could have just bolted into something where everything was kind of already done for me.
And the purpose was to share resources.
Absolutely. Share resources. Yeah. Like, first and foremost is to share resources.
Once you set this up for a group of firms who want to join this, I guess, fraternity, if you want to call it that.
It's a good name for it.
Yeah. Do you, is it a one-shot fee on your part or is it a continuous fee?
It's an ongoing fee because there are obviously ongoing overheads.
Well, would the person who's listening to this, would they want your service?
Look, it depends on where they are in their career. Like I said, the typical partner that kind of joins the network is like late 20s, probably early 30s. They're, okay, you know, they're CA, CPA kind of minted. They've got their, you know, EA probably. Actually, I don't even, do you need your EA, your enrolled agent's license, if you are a CPA? I don't think you do in America, do you?
Not really.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah.
Because you need both in Australia. So you've got to sit two different or, you know, keep two different memberships. But that's a whole nother story. So, yeah, like I guess if they kind of fit within that demographic, you know, they've usually got like 5 to 10 years worth of public practice experience, plus all of the qualifications and designations. I feel like, you know, most people listening to your show are like well before that in terms of career because they're trying to get through the CPA program, right?
That's true. But I'm sure there are people listening who are already certified.
Yeah, that's a good point. And look, I think the important thing to underscore with this is that a codex is not unique in this situation. I am strongly of the belief, and I like the term fraternity, by the way, I'm strongly like of the belief that, you know, accounting is going to go the way of this kind of like go back to the cottage industry kind of style that it was like 100+ years ago, where I think I'm expecting to see more and more people go into practice on their own. And the main reason for that is because barriers to entry to public practice have like evaporated over the last 20 years. Again, with the proliferation of the internet and all of the technology associated with it, I'm not kidding when I say laptop and internet connection and boom, you're in practice. You know, you don't need an office. You don't need a photocopier. You don't need $250,000 buy-in to buy into this. It's like if you know how to do accounting and you've got a laptop and an internet connection, you can do accounting. You know, and I think that's going to be how, you know, what the future of the profession looks like in terms of the
labor market. Yeah, you're providing services to people who maybe are sole practitioners, but they're afraid to go into practice because they don't have the knowledge, say, of artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
They don't have international taxation experience.
And then I think the other thing is that they don't want to do it on their own. You know,
exactly.
Like I think, you know, we're very social creatures and, you know, I think that's probably the number one thing that I missed when I went into practice was it's like, you know, you want to talk by the water cooler, but there's no one to talk to, you know. So I think, and even if you get stuck on a tricky tax problem or you want a second opinion, who do you talk to when you're in sole practice? You've got no one, right? And I think, you know, that's kind of, you know, that's going to change over the next 20 years.
Yeah, because I remember I started a practice and I was a sole practitioner. And
well, you know what it was like then.
Yeah, I mean, if I had a question, I didn't have anybody I could really call and
exactly
discuss an issue with.
Yep.
It just wasn't that. Well, there was no internet. There was, you know, now there's so much technology. I guess you can get people to help you with your service.
Yeah, so I'm expecting like an explosion in these kind of like, call them what you will, fraternities. I like to use the word guild, you know, so like from the olden days where you'd have like, you know, blacksmiths guilds as an example, it's like, it's the accounting guild. So, you know, it's like I said, the cottage industry, I think accounting is going to go back to that because the barriers to entry are just no longer there.
Do you know that there's a lot of people not majoring in accounting? Well, they're majoring in accounting, but they may not be taking the CPA exam in the United States.
Yeah, I've been reading that in Accounting Today. You see the odd article, you know, kind of crop up every, you know, second or third month is that like, you know, I guess the CPA, you know, enrollments or whatever are like waning in popularity. I remember seeing one, I guess today, I can't remember what it was. I think it was like 25% or something. You know, of recently minted CPAs said that they wouldn't recommend it to a friend. That's probably because the exam's so hard to pass, right?
Well, also the you know, you go work for a big four firm, they work you to death.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think that's actually an important part of the profession, right? You know, I call it, you know, around here doing your four, right? And I mean that like 4 years in a big practice, and you have to look at it like a prison sentence, right? Because the thing is, it's look, I'm going to be real with people here. You know, and that's what I was told by my mentor when I first started working in public was it's like, just think of this as a prison sentence. Yeah. And it's like, you'll get out in 4 years. And it's like, in the meantime, you shut up and you put in the hours and you put in the work. Yeah. Because, you know, once you're minted in terms of the qualifications, like the designation and, you know, that 4 years of experience and the bachelor's degree that you picked up in college, it's like you can write your ticket into corporate world. You can fast track your way to six figures. But like, that's going to be a lot harder to do if you haven't put in your 4 years, you know?
Well, unfortunately, the fact in the States that they now require more than just a bachelor's degree to sit for the CPA exam. You know,
what is it these days?
It's 150 hours, which is means the bachelor's degree in the States is generally like 120 credits.
Okay, yep.
But now they want you to have 150 hours. So you can get that by either taking additional courses.
Yep.
You don't have to go on for a master's degree. Or a lot of people just, you know, going on for a master's degree in accounting. And they feel this. They don't want to spend the extra year of tuition where they could go into another area, which might be related, like finance.
Computer science.
And they can make more.
Yeah, finance is a good example, right?
You know,
yeah.
Artificial intelligence. But they figure, hey, I can start out, maybe get a job in finance, if I major in finance instead, and go for 4 years and get a higher starting salary than going 5 years for accounting. And accounting still has sort of an image problem, you know, dull people.
Look, it's got an image problem. It's got a pay problem. It's got a conditions problem. And I think, you know, young people do need to be pragmatic about this and think about like, well, what is the future of, you know, whatever career I'm choosing, you know? And it's like, look, if you are, you know, a high school, you know, student, right, in your final year, and you're looking at the difference between, do I want to be an investment banker? Okay. Or do I want to be a CPA? Right. And you kind of weigh up, okay, well, how long do I need to spend in school? You know, what's the pay going to be like? What are the working conditions going to be like, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I guess each profession is kind of in competition with one another in, you know, in terms of like the market for talent. And I guess accounting kind of just needs to appear as an equally, if not more attractive, you know, profession than, you know, some of its would be competitors, let's say law, finance, computer science, et cetera, et cetera.
I think the American Institute of CPAs, I mean, this is my opinion. I don't think they're really marketing the CPA designation as they could. For example, you have these people going and majoring in finance, mm-hmm. right? Because they don't have to go for the fifth year for the CPA, that type of thing. But a finance degree is a very good degree as long as the economy is really booming.
Yeah. Right?
If the economy takes, you know, a dive, all those people in finance, all right, a good amount of them are going to lose their jobs.
Yep.
But there'll still be jobs for accountants.
That's
because
true.
They have to clean up the mess.
You got to sell that, right?
But they don't sell that. Yep. That's a shame.
Yep.
All right. I wish they would just hire me for $5 million a year. And I'd be happy to go out.
As the chief marketing officer for AICPA.
Marketing.
I hope someone from AICPA is listening.
I hope so. But anyway, now we were having a little discussion before the actual show, you want to call this a show. And we were discussing that a lot of people are interested now in cryptocurrency, blockchain. All right.
Absolutely.
Now, do you think that's an interesting area to go into? And what is it?
Look, I think it is personally, I think it's a fascinating area. Particularly when I think about it from, the impact from, you know, both the accounting perspective, but then also the finance perspective, probably more so the finance perspective. I think the implications of it are absolutely, you know, enormous. And I guess for the record, I'm not like a fair weather sort of Bitcoin person. It's like I've been, you know, looking at this space for like almost 5 years now. And, you know, I just kind of came to the conclusion that it's like, wow, this is going to be massively disruptive to the finance industry.
Why?
And the analogy that I use is like, let's say that you want to go buy some Walmart stock, okay? You think about all of the steps that you have to actually go through to affect that transaction. Okay. Now I'm not intimately familiar with, I guess, you know, trading on the NYSE or anything like that in terms of the actual administrative and regulatory
thing. Right.
But I will tell you from the Australian experience. Okay. I want to go buy some, I'll call it Woolworth stock here in Australia. Okay. Step one. Okay. I need a stockbroker. Okay. Now, nobody calls their stockbroker anymore. Actually, I know a few people that actually do, but you know, I need a stockbroker to place the trade for me. Okay. So I'll log on to my E-Trade account and I'll, you know, buy a 1,000 shares in Woolworths. Okay. Boom. I've got, you know, middleman number one. Okay. That broker will then basically place the trade on the market with the stock exchange. Okay. Stock exchange, middleman number two. You see where I'm getting on this?
Okay. Good. Yeah?
Now, the person who's actually selling that stock is another stockbroker. So that's the third middleman you've got in that transaction, okay? But then you need checks and balances, don't you, Phil, right? So that's where the clearinghouses come in, right? So you've got the, you know, the clearinghouses, and then you've got the fifth middleman, which is basically the share registry service, all to affect one transaction. And what I wanted to do was quite simple, right? I wanted to buy some Woolworths shares. But in the meantime, I've gone through five different entities essentially to affect that transaction. Now, I understand, appreciate the need for checks and balances and, you know, counterparty risk and all of that sort of stuff. But understandably, all of those actions cost money, right? And that gets loaded into your brokerage fee. Now, I mean, the good thing is that, you know, through the internet over the last sort of 15 years, we've been able to push the price of brokerage like right down. And, you know, that's been a good thing. But I guess the question is like, well, why does it even exist anymore? Now, in order to affect that same transaction on blockchain, all I would need to do is punch into my computer, buy 100, you know, 1,000 Woolworths shares. Yeah. On the other end of that transaction would be someone selling 1,000 Woolworths shares, or maybe they're selling 2,000 and they'll sell me, you know, 1,000 of them, you know, if I've got the right price. But that's me selling to you with no brokers, with no clearinghouses, with no registries, with no exchanges, just on the market. But then the same thing is, it's like, I don't trust you and you don't trust me, right? And I guess, you know, in the finance world, that's why we needed all of these checks and balances and middlemen, yeah, is to kind of, you know, arbitrate that transaction. But I guess in blockchain, it's like, I don't trust you, you don't trust me, you don't have to trust me, and I don't have to trust you to actually affect this transaction, because we have got, you know, transparency throughout the transaction. And, you know, we've got everything is recorded and affected on the blockchain. And I think that's very exciting. And not just in terms of, I guess, you know, share trading as an example. You think about real estate transactions, exact same thing. In fact, you think about any asset of any value. And this is where you start talking about the implications of blockchain on inventory management and supply chain logistics. Any asset that's got value can be traced through that chain. And that obviously has some pretty profound impacts, both in cost reduction, but then also in speed of transaction from, I guess, a trading perspective. And I guess that kind of, you know, naturally just segues into the implications, you know, from an accounting standpoint.
From a standpoint of someone who's not in this area, like myself, it's very simple for me to understand that if I want to buy some shares of, by the way, Woolworths, are they still in business in Australia?
Yeah, doing really well.
There's no Woolworths in the States, believe it or not.
Is it a brand in the United States?
It used to be called FW Woolworth.
Yes.
That was the original chain. And over the years, that was called the old Five and Dime, they called it.
And yeah, gotcha.
They have since, you don't see them anymore. That was, in fact, if you ask the typical student now or someone in their 20s, 30s, hey, you ever heard of FW Woolworth? They'll say, no. But anyway, it was a retail type store for those.
Well, fun story. You know, I know America's got Target. Australia's got Target as well. America's got Kmart. Australia's got Kmart as well. I'm pretty sure they're owned by completely different companies.
Probably. Yeah.
I think that the brand, it's a brand licensing thing or something, but different companies.
It's so different times. There was no internet. There was no shopping on the internet. And, you know, for example, you want to go into the old days. Okay, so I feel like it's time to put me to the glue factory.
Off to the blacksmith?
Yeah, I went to the blacksmith with my horse, Lexus. And no. But no, let's go back here. I want to buy stock in Okay. They call it the Wilco, actually, for Woolworth.
Yep. And okay.
I want to buy stock in Woolworth. All right. And exactly what it is. My broker, I say, get me 100 shares. All right. Now, you go into the stock exchange, they're publicly traded, and he will find someone who wants to sell those shares. All right. And basically, that's the way that we trade securities in this country.
That's right.
But I'm paying for it in cash. Okay.
Correct.
With blockchain, how am I paying for this?
Oh, look, yeah, that's a fair question. You're paying for it in cryptocurrency. And
what is cryptocurrency? For example, what is it? Wampum or that's Indian money, by the way. Wampum or beads or.
Look, Bitcoin is obviously the most well-known and the most prolific of them. So in order for, you know, us to kind of affect this transaction, the actual currency itself would need to be on its own blockchain.
How do I get, I'm not thinking, is Bitcoins what it says? Is it coins or?
No, physical coins. It's basically, it's no different to, you know, the balance in your bank account. It's kind of like, you know, computer says that you've got, you know, this much, you know, this many Bitcoin. And it's like, well, that's what you've got. In order to buy that Bitcoin, you'd obviously have to trade that for, US dollars in the first instance, right? So you would have to go to, a Bitcoin like exchange, as an example, and find someone that's first willing to exchange American dollars into Bitcoin. And you'll go, here, I've got American dollars. I want your Bitcoin. And then like, you know, buying those shares, you would first agree on the price. Okay. But then kind of once you've entered, you know, what I would call the crypto gateway and you've got, you know, some Bitcoin in your pocket, then, you know, you've kind of opened yourself up to this world, this plethora of crypto assets. And you can sort of, you know, chop that Bitcoin and trade that for whatever you want in that crypto asset world.
It's interesting. I was in the supermarket last week here, and they actually have machines now that have Bitcoins.
That's right. Bitcoin ATMs.
Excuse me?
Bitcoin ATMs. They're becoming more and more popular these days.
Now, obviously I didn't go over and use it, but if I did use it, what would I do there?
Good question.
How would that work?
You'd either have like, let's say, you know, $100 in cash on you. Or you'd have $100, you know, on your checking account. So you'd either insert your card or you'd insert the cash. And what that would do is it would then actually spit out a receipt, funnily enough, that would basically have what's called your wallet address on the receipt. Now, you can then take any sort of Bitcoin app and basically scan that receipt for all intents and purposes. And that gives you access to the funds, but in Bitcoin now.
But that only works if the Safeway, I go to Safeway. That's only if Safeway accepts Bitcoins. Is that correct?
Now, this is, I guess, the interesting thing in terms of commerce, insofar as crypto world is concerned. They seem to be two separate realities at the moment, you know. So you can't go to Safeway and go, here, I want to pay for my groceries in Bitcoin, right? You can't do that yet. And even there are obviously stories and anecdotes of stores that do accept Bitcoin. Those transactions are always denominated and pegged in American dollars, right? So it's not like, you know, you go to Safeway and the price is always going to be, you know, one Bitcoin per grocery shop, you know, but you can go to, to Safeway and expect that, you know, $100 in groceries gets you the same thing, you know, pretty consistently every single time you go to the store. So long as, I guess, Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies are pegged to, the local fiat currency, they essentially serve very limited purpose, I guess, in traditional commerce.
What's the advantage of a Bitcoin over currency? Does Bitcoin go up and down in value?
Yeah, massively, if you've been paying attention to the news for the last couple of years. So what are the key distinctions in terms of like, what are the differences? I guess, you know, when you think about the US dollar, you know, the US dollar is basically backed by, you know, the US federal government. it's kind of, you know, legal tender.
Good faith and credit of the
England. Yeah, yeah, that's right. You know, ever since we went off of the gold standard, right? And I guess, you know, Bitcoin is backed by no one, right? And I think that's actually arguably one of the advantages that a lot of proponents will argue is that it is decentralized. So there is not one, you know, federal Bitcoin reserve or anything like that. And I think that kind of dovetails into the other sort of key consideration with Bitcoin is that, you know, there's scarcity, right? So there's only a finite number of Bitcoin that will ever be in circulation that is a known quantity that people can kind of, you know, interact in the marketplace with certainty, right? I guess with, you know, the US dollar and other fiat currencies, it's like, well, you can't really stop the government from printing a whole, you know, few billion dollars and then pumping that into the economy and then thus deflating the value of it. I guess people have certainty with Bitcoin and, you know, other cryptocurrencies that at least there's certainty. I guess those are the main.
But how does it go up and down in value? I don't know. All right. You have this Bitcoins out there. How can they go up in value if you want to consider it like an investment?
The same reason that, you know, people's, you know, company stock will go up and down in value. And that actually has less to do with the financial fundamentals of that company and more to do with the market hype expectations of that company's prospects, right? So, you know, like any other market, I guess Bitcoin is based on purely on supply and demand forces only, right? So the price of Bitcoin will increase when demand increases and there are more people that are swapping out US dollars for Bitcoin. And conversely, the price will fall when people are like, oh, maybe I don't want this Bitcoin, and they're swapping, Bitcoin for US dollars again. And what I've seen over the last few years is the price of Bitcoin has kind of followed these boom bust kind of like hype cycles, sort of, you know, pretty consistently, every 18 months or so. And obviously nowhere near as stable as, you know,
stocks.
The US dollars is, well, no, more the US dollar or the Australian dollar, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, stock is probably somewhere in the middle in terms of volatility.
It sounds to me like don't get involved in the investments of Bitcoins unless you have knowledge of it or someone who is working with you has knowledge of it. Is that, it sounds like sort
of... Yeah, absolutely. It's probably one of the most volatile asset classes in existence right now. But I think, you know, we're getting distracted from, you know, what the real story here is. It's like, you know, this is less about buying and speculating on Bitcoin or crypto assets. And it's more about actually learning and understanding, I guess, the principles behind it and then the technology that actually underpins it. And I think that's probably like the most important consideration for people that are listening. It's like, look, by all means, you know, speculate on it the same amount you would, you know, spend at the casino. But I think more importantly, you know, as if your career depends on it, because it probably will in 20 years' time, start to educate yourself about the technology and I guess the principles that actually underpin this.
Does this all fall into the definition of artificial intelligence?
No, so those are, I guess, two completely distinct technological trends that are kind of playing out at the moment as we speak.
You're involved, though, in artificial intelligence, like bots and all that stuff?
Look, I'm involved in, I guess, technology and where technology is heading insofar as the future is concerned. And one of the key sort of components of my research is kind of going, okay, well, what's the next big thing going to be, right? And the way you and I are kind of talking about blockchain right now is kind of as if we're in the early 90s, say like 1994, talking about email, you know, and here I am, some kook on the television, basically talking about how email is going to completely transform business. You know, so I guess my job here in terms of research is to go, okay, cool. Well, imagine if you were, let's say, an investor, yeah, or a business person. In the early 90s, and you've got some money and you've got some time, and you're going to go, okay, cool, I want to move on to the next hot thing, right? And you spend 90% of your time researching, I guess, trends and patterns and economics and all of this stuff to try and figure out what exactly the next hot thing, quote unquote, is, so that you can make investment and business decisions on that. So look, I think there should be no doubt that artificial intelligence and blockchain are two, you know, big hype trains at the moment insofar as technology is concerned. And rightly so, because I think the prospects of both of those things are extremely exciting and revolutionary. I guess the core question for me is, it's like, well, which one is going to pop first? Yeah. And I mean, here's the thing, you can't have one without the other and then vice versa. But it's really kind of determining, going like, is the technology timeline, you know, for artificial intelligence, is that going to be a realistic prospect within the next 10 years or not? Is blockchain going to be a realistic prospect in the next 10 years? You know, because, you know, you can say, yeah, artificial intelligence is going to be a huge thing, and you would be correct. But I mean, the hardest part of this is going, well, when is it going to be a huge thing? And for me, you know, my conclusion on that, artificial intelligence is not going to be a huge thing in terms of part of our life for another 20 plus years.
You really feel it's going to be that long?
Absolutely. And that's basically...
What are you basing that on?
The consensus opinion. So there was a survey done, and don't quote me on this in terms of what the specific paper is, because I can't remember off the top of my head, but there was a research paper done that basically aggregated the opinions of all of the top artificial intelligence scientists with a simple question going like, when do you think artificial general intelligence and when do you think artificial superintelligence are going to become practical realities? And basically just give us a year. And all they did was then plot those answers, you know, on a bell, you know, a bell curve, and said, okay, boom, here's the median. And that median, you know, for artificial general intelligence, I think is not 2045, you know, which is still 26 years
away.
Are
you talking about artificial intelligence that's going to do routine jobs and like accounting firms, that type of thing? Or what is your definition?
I'm talking about artificial intelligence that has the cognition of a human being.
Oh, okay. But they're using, as you know, artificial intelligence now to do the routine jobs in accounting firms.
Look, right. I think it's important not to conflate, I guess, rule-based programs with artificial intelligence. So yes, there have been some advances in terms of machine learning and natural language processing, which have been impressive. And I think the impact on them has been, you know, reasonably encouraging in terms of the accounting profession. But I think the thing that's moved the needle the most in terms of like the accounting profession insofar as technology is concerned is the first one is, I guess, cloud computing and the ability to connect app A to app B. That's obviously saved us a lot. And the second one is just about being able to program rules into systems, right? So I can tell the computer, you know, if transaction says Uber, then code to travel expenses, right? Now, I first have to teach the computer that manually as a human, right? And again, like this is where the machine learning side of things comes into. It's like, okay, cool. Well, let's pass through every single QuickBooks user, you know, across the entire country, see how many of them have Uber, you know, transactions, and see where they code them to manually. And then we can start, the machine can basically learn and start to build a model of going, okay, you know, kind of like Amazon recommends books to you, going like people who bought this book also bought this. You know, QuickBooks can kind of suggest, you know, people who coded to this account, you know, people who had a transaction like this coded to this account. Do you want to code to that account? But again, this is all fairly routine stuff that we could have done in Excel, you know, 10 years ago if we wanted to. So for me, that's not groundbreaking technology. What is groundbreaking technology is when, you know, computers have the cognition of a human being. You know, I think that's when we're really starting to talk about AI.
Thank you so much. I mean, I am in a way glad that I'm not starting out in this profession. I'll tell you why. To me, learning all this new stuff would be a nightmare. Now, maybe that's because I'm not as young as you are, but maybe younger people find this fascinating that it's like my grandson. He's 13 years old. I have a problem with my cell phone. I give it to him and he corrects it. So I guess it's, you know, it's what they grow up with today. So, but it fascinates me how you know all this information. You were a child prodigy, is that correct?
I wouldn't go that far. But I mean, look, the reason I know all of this stuff is because I'm connected to the internet. And I think, you know, insofar as, sorry, what was it, your grandson you were talking about?
Yes.
Yeah. Insofar as your grandson's concerned, it's like, you know, he is in a better position than I was, you know, because it's like I didn't have a cell phone that was connected to the internet when I was 13.
True.
So it's like he does. And like you try and even comprehend having access to the entirety of humanity's knowledge literally at your fingertips in real time. So that like any question that you have, anything that you want to learn, you can learn in an instant. We didn't have that growing up. You know, and I think to be empowered with that is actually quite profound in terms of the impact on the species.
Well, Chris, thank you very much. And we appreciate you staying up this late to be on this podcast. And Chris, if people really wanted to contact you for any reason, all right, you would love to hear from people, would you not?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm actually more than happy to shoot the breeze with anyone in the accounting profession. The best channels to actually get me on are probably Twitter and LinkedIn. So Twitter, my handle is at ChrisHooper87. And like LinkedIn, I guess, Google Chris Hooper Accounting Futurist and you'll find me somewhere on there.
Chris, good luck with all your ventures in the future. And unfortunately, the people cannot see you, but I can tell you he's got a lot of personality. You know, nice guy. He smiled during this entire podcast. Thanks, Chris.
Anyway, thanks, Bill.
Hey, Chris, stay well. Good luck with everything. And thanks again for doing this podcast.
No worries. I'll hit you up when I'm stateside, all right?
I look forward to it.
Once again, I'd like to thank you for being the best part of CPA Review and More with your host, Phil Yeager. If you have any questions or topics you'd like to hear on the show, or if you'd like to be a guest on the show to share your story, we want to hear from you. Send me an email to the studio at podcast@YeagerCPAReview.com. If you're enjoying the content that we're providing, we'd greatly appreciate it if you'd submit a review to the Apple iTunes podcast app to let us know how we're doing. If you're in the market for a CPA review course or simply want to find out more about the CPA exam and what Yeager has to offer, check out YeagerCPAReview.com or call our office and we'll answer any questions you may have. The link and the phone number will be in the description of this podcast. Here at Team Yeager, we are excited to tell you about our new Yeager CPA Review subscription format. It's the same great Yeager CPA Review course that you know and love on an all-new month-to-month, no-commitment subscription format. Check it out today. Once again, my name's Rob Medford. I'm your executive producer and director here at the Yeager Studios. And until next time, take care and be audit you can be.
Thank you for listening. Thank you for listening to CPA Review and More with Phil Yeager.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.